Evening. This is Sarah Robinson, host of BBS Radio's Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome you, our listening audience, as we continue conversations on the relationship between art making and transformation. Be sure to check out my new website at www.consciouscreating.net for more information on the show and my creative endeavors. I'm privileged to welcome yet another distinguished guest from the fields of writing and visual art. Jerry Winstrom is the author of The Inspired Heart and the subject of the film In the Hands of Alchemy, The Art and Life of Jerry Winstrom. His current artworks are large mixed-media dimensional boxes of weathered cedar and found objects, which are often mechanized and contain secret compartments. In addition to his work as an artist, he and his wife, singer Marilyn Strong, offer workshops and lectures on aspects of self-exploration. Welcome, Jerry.
Thank you, Sarah.
Your early years were spent in Spring Valley, New York, the son of a working-class parents in a predominantly black neighborhood called Boot Hill.
Yes.
Who were the Boot Hill boys?
Excuse me, I didn't get your question.
Who were the Boot Hill boys?
Well, it was kind of a neighborhood gang that, you know, I think we just sort of named ourselves that.
Were they into art?
No. No. I think there's a whole creative way to live when you're kind of living in a way on the streets. You know, I think it's a very creative and, you know, it has a lot to do with survival. I think it's just a different kind of creativity.
Would you say that those early years and experiences informed your art in any way?
Well, I wouldn't say it informed my art, but I think it had a lot to do with, you know, my journey has been so much about facing my fears and, you know, and kind of calling up necessary courage, you know, whatever the moment might kind of call for. And I think growing up in that kind of atmosphere, I certainly learned to live courageously, and that has been, you know, more than anything else, a huge part of my journey, you know, having ultimately walked into the void in the way that I did.
Did you ever see, I mean, I don't know if back then there were drive-by shootings or things like that, but did you actually encounter death?
Well, you know, I did not in that way. It was earlier before things got really bad, I think. You know, the drugs were just kind of coming in a big way, and that's when we moved out of the neighborhood.
And then after high school, you attended community college and studied art at a state university in New York. And I read that you received particular encouragement from one of your art teachers at the state university. What did the teacher tell you?
Well, coming, you know, sort of out of nowhere in many ways and not being a very good student, when I went to college, I was just very determined to find some meaning to my life and do something important. And I was extremely driven right from the beginning. And immediately, you know, going from very poor grades in high school to getting on the dean's list the first year. But I think just, you know, I think in a certain way, because I, you know, I worked hard and I had a certain amount of talent, I was something hopeful for the small community college. I mean, I think they kind of held me in a way that was very nice for me to be held as well, because, you know, I think I didn't have a lot of self-esteem. So all of a sudden being somebody special, even if it's in a small environment, it did a lot to encourage my life as an artist.
And this particular teacher said that you should actually, that you had whatever it took to be an artist and that you should actually leave, right?
Oh, yes. Well, that was when I moved on to New Paltz University, State University. Yes, I mean, I was about to finish up school and get a degree, and I was at that point producing such a large body of work, and was self-motivated. I mean, school almost felt like it was dragging me down. And at one point, one of my instructors said that. I mean, he suggested I just go out and do it, which I immediately walked out the door and never returned.
That was what I was most interested in, is that you you just did it.
Yeah.
So well, it must have resonated with something you knew inside of yourself to be true.
Yes.
And then at 29, what most people talk about is this experience that you had. It was a profound shift, which you say took you away from the discipline of active doing, that is painting, and carried you to a new discipline of conscious being. Would you describe the shift more of a process, or was it an actual event for you?
Well, in it was really kind of both. I mean, the process that kind of led up to it. You know, Yogananda has a saying, to set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. And that's a kind of metaphoric death.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at the point where I made that shift, I was producing more art than ever. And at some level, art, you know, the process of doing art in the way that I was beginning to feel empty and dead. And so, you know, it was a long process that I got to that place. And after fasting for a month, I decided just to go on this long fast. And I sensed something stirring that needed to change. And I just got really clear that, and here's where some of that courage comes in. I mean, it was a terrifying choice in a way. I just got very clear that I could keep doing what I was doing. And I was sort of on top of the game, you might say. I mean, I was in a building full of artists, and, you know, I was producing more than anyone. So I could keep doing what I was doing, but it felt like a fear-based choice. Or there was some intuitive sense that if I could let it all go, I would have to become the creativity that, in a sense, I was dabbling with in the studio and identifying with as a person. And so with the strength of, and that intuitive sense of things, it was extremely exciting and at the same time terrifying. So with those two choices, I destroyed all my work, I gave everything I owned away, and I decided to trust life unconditionally and live creatively.
And of course now it's become part of common vernacular, the cliche, jump or leap and the net will appear, but in fact that was the case with you, was it not?
It certainly was.
You left.
In many ways, it continues to be so. I mean, I never would have been able to live that strange and lonely journey if there wasn't some magic in life that carried my life when all else failed, including my own efforts and my own will and my own good intentions and everything that, you know, I thought I was as a human being. When all else failed, there was always something that came through. And it was directly related, I think. I think the gods meet you halfway. You know, if we can make a leap, and I don't think everyone has to do it like I did, but I think in some way there's something in each of our lives that's calling us to make a change and to give ourselves a new level of courage and trust. And if we can do that, the gods meet us halfway, you know, more than halfway. However much we can give is how much we get. And if we can give it all at some level, then I think we can get it all.
So the small deaths or giving up of renunciations of certain parts in our lives that are no longer working, your life was sort of a metaphor for that, of renunciation and then restoration or resurrection even.
Well, I think that sort of mythos is very much a part of the human condition. I mean, it's in the Christ story, it's in the Buddha.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's in many religious traditions. It's the meaning of sacrifice. You know, sacrifice means to make sacred. If we can take all that we love and all of that we think we are, our identity, and we can sort of put it on the altar with absolute, you know, trust and let it go, I think what happens, in a way, it gets sanctified and comes back to us. Sacrifice means literally to make sacred. And it has come back. I mean, it's you know, I don't think there are any deals to be made, but I think if we really live our truth and we can get to the place where we're willing to let go the matter of things, I mean, it's amazing how it comes back. I mean, even as an artist, I became much more known for destroying my art than I ever did for creating it. Now and then there's a film and a book and all of that.
Ironic,
came
isn't
later.
It? Back to your early art, was it in the day considered commercially viable? I mean, were you making money?
Well, some, but you know, my work was pretty dark because I would paint into my fears. You know, I did a whole series on suicide. I did a series on the Holocaust. You know, some of those old paintings are actually on my website at handsofalchemy.com if anyone wants to see them. But you know, they weren't that pleasant. So, but I think there was a lot of interest stirring. You know, there was a film that was being made at that time, and there was a lot going on around it, but not a lot of money, even though there was a lot of money being, you know, going on in Soho at that time.
I had the experience, and I imagine other artists have had the experience of making money. I made a lot of money as an actor in commercials and industrial videos, and feeling very much, as you described, feeling dead and alienated from my art. I was, in some cases, doing things in commercials that were antithetical to my belief system. They were actually very, you know, opposite of it. So I can relate, and I admire your courage for walking away from something that just wasn't feeding you because you trusted there would be something else.
Well, and it fed me to a point. I mean, in a lot of ways, it was my psychological process. You know, it was my identity. You know, it was the one little place in the world, you know, the world said, what a good boy are you. You know, it was the one thing I could do that the world acknowledged me for. So I think it served as far as it did. But I think, you know, like anything, you know, I think we all come to a place where we have to leap into a greater faith in something more essential about our lives. I mean, what you described is the story of most people's lives. You know, most people do what they don't want to be doing. You know, and it's a fear-based choice because they think if they don't, their world is going to fall apart. And you know, and I think that belief system is most certainly supported if you know, our focus is fear, then we call into our lives exactly the thing that we're most afraid of. But I think also, you know, I think, you know, as much as the energy that gets released when we can let go of our fear and we can trust reality, I think it's like the essence of creativity, you know, and everything comes out of that.
I do too. I had the experience on a less dramatic level, just, and it was right around the age of 40, and a parent dying, and my husband and I, who are long-term partners, sort of looked at each other and said, there's got to be more than this, you know, doing 8 shows a week in a theater, and he was running a corporation, and we were not spending enough time with our children, and we truly did what you did, just he sold his company, and we took off when we left, and sort of reinvented, you know, I got out of the theater and started writing, and so I do know on some level what that's like, but I don't know about total renunciation, and I'm intrigued by it, as I'm sure most people are. And thank you for that example. I mean, it's such a blessing to us.
Well, I mean, I think we all do what we need to do. And, you know, I don't think there's any way to sort of quantify. You know, it's not a more or less thing. I mean, at some level, we all know where we've sold our lives down the river.
Right.
And there's a place right here and now for each of us where we can just, you know, make a leap, however large or small. You know, right here, right now, and it's that we will find is enough. And the more we're able to do that, and I think that's a big part of creativity. You know, it's like if you're an actress, you're on stage, you know that when you take a risk, there's some magic that happens, and if you play it safe, what you do is kind of boring to you and boring to your audience.
Right.
So there's a certain risk involved in opening to a new level of creativity, but I think each of us can do that in whatever small way in our lives right now, and we all have, it's like waiting for us, you know, as soon as we're ready to give ourselves to a greater extent.
Right. And during this experience, before you came back into mainstream living, let's put it that way, you wrote that living this way took me into some of the most undesirable and uninhabitable areas of the personal and collective psyche that I could have explored.
Yes.
It sounds as if you were walking toward your shadow or even a collective shadow.
Well, yes,
would you
both
say that in Jungian terms?
Yeah, it's true, and it's both of those things. Well, if you think about it, I mean, what is freedom if not freedom from fear?
Right.
And so if we decide to free our lives and to be fearless, the only place of freedom is right down the middle of our fears. So, you know, in some way, everything that scares us the most. And that's a good deal of what my book's about. It's stories of those transitional moments where, you know, I would walk into the thing that was most terrifying. And it involved everything, you know, from street violence to, you know, just the initial leap into the void and letting go of an identity. I mean, many levels of that. But I think, you know, if that is available to all of us, that possibility.
Absolutely. Now, when you engaged in this dramatic act, I don't know if you call it renunciation, that's the way I would describe it. I can imagine a few people thought you'd lost your mind.
Yes. I mean, some of the first reactions were that. I mean, I was at the time friends with Jean Houston and her husband, Bob, mm-hmm. and they were working with artists and interested, you know, in this sort of creative process. And, you know, it was interesting that Jean was the first person to call who, in fact, thought I had lost it.
Well, you had been hanging out in an insane asylum.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I think that's the risk. I mean, I didn't know myself if that were the case. All I knew is that there was something very exciting and unreasonable about making that choice. And, you know, if there wasn't the mystery that continued to kick in and to hold my life in a particular way, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to continue living that way because it was, you know, it was 15 years before, you know, and in many ways I still live that way. There are many things coming into life now in a different kind of a way, but I think the foundation of my reality is still the ability to let it all go. I mean, even now, I'm living in a beautiful place on Whidbey Island doing exactly what I want to be doing. I mean, even now, when I become too attached to my world or to my beautiful wife, there are just things I know between God and I'm willing to let it all go. And there's something about that sensibility and meaning it. It's, you know, it's not like you can fake that point of view.
Right, let go and let God and that kind of thing.
Yes, I mean, there's something about the ability to do that because I had done it so completely at that time. It's become the template, and it's the very thing that continues to renew life in the cyclical nature. You know, if you look at our lives, a kind of death experience comes around over and over. There's a time when we're just flying high. Everything comes easy.
Right.
We're very
right.
loved and lovable and loving.
Inflation, I think.
And then it all kind of comes, you know, and we get to a place in the cycle where we feel none of that and nothing's working and it all feels like, you know, it's lost here. And I think it's at that time that the kind of promise of the initial experience comes through like an element of grace and not like some kind of accomplishment. You know, it's not like a strategic arrangement that you've made with the gods or something. It's more like if you can do it once, you know, I even think that's the meaning in the Christian theology, but it's in other traditions as well, of eternal life. I mean, in some way, when death comes around on the cycle of things, eternal life is like the ability to have grace come through at the point of death over and over again.
That's renewal.
And that's the kind of eternity. It's like eternal renewal.
Right. Yes, definitely. So you use that energy of death and renewal even today to sort of fuel your creativity and your joy of living. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Well, I think it uses us. And I think what we do with it, we either retreat in fear and buffer ourselves. We get bigger bank accounts. We need more and more material things. Mm. We need, you know, all the things that make us feel comfortable and safe. Or we give ourselves to the experience and trust it. But it's not like any of us can control its coming around. I mean, it's just the nature of reality. I think we can, the best we can do is come to terms with it and ultimately come to celebrate it. I mean, at first it's like learning to dance. You know, the steps seem clumsy and awkward and we don't know what we're doing. And after a while, the music comes on and it becomes a dance. And you know, that's one of the real possibilities of facing our fears. And if we don't, it's almost like death follows us through our whole lives. You know, it's like cracking the whip, you know, behind everything we do.
Interesting. And the shadow will follow us if we don't lean into it sometimes.
Yes, I mean, and in a way, you know, death is the shadow. If you think about it, so if we're talking facing our fear, what's the ultimate fear? It's of our demise. What if we walk into it and find out that, you know, there's life there? What if we're so afraid of being alone that we face our loneliness and we find that people love us even more because we know how to be alone instead of being so needy? I mean, there's this incredible paradox in place that the very thing we love, if we can let go of it, or walk into the thing that we're so afraid of not having, what we'll find is that we end up getting the thing we want anyway. And that's the paradox and the mystery. And if we're out there strategically arranging everything to our advantage, and I know many people, and I work with many people who have done that. I mean, I know people who are millionaires, at the place in their life where they should celebrate their retirement, their lives fall apart, and they've got their $1 million, but they don't have their soul, or their beautiful wife walks out, or things go wrong, and they just don't have the thing that they thought they were going to have.
Yes, I see a lot of that. I had a friend once whose husband, at the age of about 60, was dying of a rare sort of brain tumor, and we were in her apartment, and she said, "Look at all these books. Look at these thousands of books. My husband has read them all, but he doesn't have a soul." And that was just so profound that we can grasp that anything, whether it's knowledge, money, relationship, but unless we deal with ourselves and our own fear, then we really have nothing, do we?
We don't, not in the end. I mean, it's just, you know, in many ways we buffer. They become buffers. They become defenses. You know, like we think if we fine-tune our intellect enough, then we're going to be smarter than the nature of reality somehow. But it's always about trust, you know, intelligent trust. But it's always about trusting in new levels and co-creating with something more mysterious than our old boring minds.
Mm. You know, I've often wondered about high levels of creativity and madness. whether there isn't some sort of connection. Does one have to go through a dark night of the soul or a sort of renunciation, as you did, in order to get to that place where we're consciously creating, where we're creating and co-creating with our source?
Well, and it's not necessarily madness. I think madness is the avoidance of madness. You know, I think we go crazy when we're so afraid of the emptiness that's before us.
Mm.
But, you know, at some level, the answer, I would answer your question by saying, yes, we have to. But it's, again, it's not in like the way I did it. I think in some way, we all have to come to the place where we realize that what we have is not quite enough. And instead of like fearing that that reality, you know, or faking it. You know, we're very good at finessing, and we act like we're completely in control, and we become very controlling as a result. I think to be able to face the fact that we don't know, and it's okay not to know, and to trust, and to sort of open a dialogue with the mystery, I think in some way to get there, you have to fail. And you have to acknowledge that your human ability is limited, your creative ability. You know, and it really comes across like a kind of death. I mean,
but do you believe that we're limited? Do you believe that our creative ability is limited?
I believe that our human manipulation is limited. And I think if we're coming from a place of will, intelligence, and good intention, I think it's going to come to a place, again, as Yogananda says, to set out on any holy purpose, even the best of intention, and to die along the way is to succeed. I mean, it's the Christ story. You know, it's the Buddha sitting until he was enlightened, you know, willing to die, and in fact, almost dying, in some way. And, you know, and it's not like we have to arrange that event. It happens to us by way of a divorce. I mean, all we have to do is be present in our lives. It's like what you said. You woke up one day and you said, my life is not my own.
Right.
You know, it's like, so what did you do? You made a choice. You know, so in other words, the you that you thought was the most you is had to, at some level, die. You know, you've described
it. I've been swept up in other people's desires for me, like my agents, rather than my desires.
Yeah.
Right.
And so you went, you know, that is the experience, and it's different for each of us. So all we have to do is tend our own lives, and
right,
we will come up against that place. So the answer is yes. To really achieve what it is we set out to achieve, we have to go through that kind of death, and we can do it consciously or we can do it fearfully. I mean, if you look at some, you know, things like our current administration or what's going on in America, it's so fear-based. You know, so in other words, we're having to change here. The world will not survive if we don't make some changes. And yet, we're so afraid. We're trying to keep this, you know, kick this old dead horse and keep it alive. And I think that's one way of dealing with change. We can fear it, or we can say, okay, I will let it all go and let something new emerge here.
You have a great article on your website, which is handsofalchemy.com, where you talk about your view of terrorism and what that's all about. It's fascinating. So it's about fear. Fear being so deeply enmeshed, not only on the individual level, but on the level of mass consciousness as well.
Well, yes, it translates into the collective. And we're so influenced by it, we don't even know we are sometimes. It's just like, I mean, there are times when, I mean, I think we all feel the discomfort of our time, and it's larger than us, but our only way to deal with it is to deal personally. You know, if the world is frightened, then I think we have to be the ones to live with courage. You know, I think it's always about what we do as individuals. If everybody's going for the last bit of what they can get, I think we have to be generous. You know, if there's greed, I think we have to not be greedy.
Yes,
you know,
I agree
it's up
with
to
that.
Each of us.
I agree with that. I think we really have to mind. What did you say? Tend to ourselves. Mind our own little plot, so that we watch how we plow it and how we care for it. And
that has a huge effect on our world. I mean, if you think about even art. You know, I believe art changes the world, and it's like, I think it's the personal breakthrough in consciousness that produces an exciting new movement or an exciting new something that emerges, that the world, it just resonates with the spirit of the time, and everyone kind of knows in their bones the rightness of this expression. And that expression comes right directly from a breakthrough in consciousness of individuals.
You think we're near a breakthrough now? Because I've been pretty frustrated with what I see in art, and I don't just mean visual arts, but all the arts.
I think we're in the throes, you know, we're kind of, again, back to the cyclical nature.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're in the death part of the cycle, and so everything's looking death and overdone, and everybody and their grandmother is and grandfather is producing, you know, art. And I think art, again, it's always been a powerful breakthrough in consciousness. And I think, you know, at the time, it all looks dead. And I think even museums don't know what to do with it because there's so much of everything. It's just become a free-for-all. But I think consciousness is here now and breaking through. And I think if we can let go and maybe even be willing not to do art at all, we might find that renewed spirit of the time and express it in some unique way. And it's inevitable that we will. You know, each of us, I think, if we can find our own true voice by being willing not to speak, I think what comes is something extremely unique and exciting, and that resonates in the world.
And you and Marilyn work with people to inspire them in this way, do you not?
We do, yes.
Tell me something about that. I mean, what have you developed? You know, a method. I can't imagine you having a method for letting go, particularly, or do you just? What do you do to inspire people?
Well, you know, I think we do workshops, and Marilyn is really the one who designs and, you know, brings the form. I'm much more spontaneous. I could just go in and I do. I'm just present with what is. But I feel most of what I do and we do is speak to groups. And, you know, we've been traveling nationally and some internationally, showing our, you know, the parabola video that was made about my life, mm-hmm. and speaking. And I think it's just so much about being in the moment with each particular audience. And it's almost like something different comes through with different audiences. You know, it so much depends on what the moment is about. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's that I feel is the place where I have to risk the most because I go into these things not knowing. In fact, you know, I even did an event for a corporate consulting firm that brought in the CEOs of all these major American corporations, and I had no idea what I was going to do. And, you know, right up to the point I got up on stage, I had no idea. And all I know is what came out was felt like the thing that needed to come out. Mm. But being able to hold that unknowing, I feel, is you know, gives me access to what it is the moment's actually about and able to put that through for other people.
I would think you'd be kind of scary to corporate leaders. You might incite something, you know, like everyone walking out the door.
But it's part of the being in the moment is you don't want to do that. So how do you speak in a less, how do you hold the essence of what it is you know to be true? And at the same time, it's like, again, you're a theater, you do theater. You know, how do you translate, you know, even the deepest mystery into a language that the audience can understand? Because that's the meaning of success, you know? If you could put out the most far-out, terrifying theories and do so in a way that they get heard and inspire people, then you have accomplished what you've set out to do. And if you look at, you know, take even corporations, I mean, they know what I'm talking about. There is such...
Yes.
That's why this person brought me in, because there was so much fear. People have lost so much money that he brought me in to speak on finding inspiration in loss, which, so they know what I'm talking about, but how do you do it in a way that they can understand?
Well, I admire the corporate leader who would do that. That's amazing.
Yeah, he's
just not part of most corporate cultures, and I know that from my husband's experiences.
Well, he's a person who has a corporation where he predicts trends, so... You know, he's somebody who he also hired me to do a monthly piece. You know, I'm sort of the fringe voice, the voice from the fringe. But, you know, they really take some of what I write about and they run with it. You know, I did a whole piece on the emergent feminine and the masculine and feminine out of balance.
Yeah.
And they went and, you know, they brought up the fact that many new women presidents are coming into place and So things like that, there's this kind of intuitive voice that I think this person is sensitive to, and he finds ways to put it through to his clients.
That's wonderful. Now you compose poetry and write essays and articles and have written your autobiography. Do you find that you get the same pleasure from writing as you do from your work as a visual artist?
Yes, I do. You know, it's different. But, you know, before I was approached by a publisher and asked to write my book, I had never written anything. And at the time, I didn't even know how to use a computer.
You write beautifully.
Well, thank you. But, I mean, what I find is it's so much like the creative process anyway. You know, you just jump in and you rough it in, and then
right.
You start to clean up the edges, and you find the mystery and what's emerging.
And you hope you have a good copy editor, too, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes. But, I mean, it's so similar that I think... I mean, one of the things I gave up when I felt with the limitation of when I originally gave up my art and changed my life was the smallness of just, you know, art being art in a particular way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I got to the place where I realized it all has to be art. I mean, I put the same kind of attention into getting out of bed in the morning and dealing with the people in my life, and, you know, each moment requires that kind of attention. It's like juggling pins, and if we decide, well, this pin doesn't matter, it comes down and hits us on the head. So I think it all has to be a creative process.
Absolutely. So your life becomes a work of art.
Well, all of our lives are, and we can make a mess of it or we can make something beautiful.
That's right. Absolutely. Let's talk about your art making. You say that the leap that you took when you denounced your former life led you to the source of all inspiration. Is this what you call God?
Well, you could call it that. It's what I also call unknowing. You know, there's a way to hold emptiness reverently, you know. I think you could call it whatever you want to. It's a good enough word for me, you know, but I think some people have a very small idea of that, and I don't want to get into that because I don't care what it's called.
Doesn't matter.
All I know is that there's some mystery well in place that we can tap into and co-create with, and I think all artists and poets and even anyone who has an inspired moment in their lives in whatever form knows about that mystery. I mean, sometimes we just call it good luck or, you know, fate, but I think we can actually cultivate that component in our lives and we can refine it. And instead of focusing on fear and getting more and more and more to make ourselves feel comfortable, we can actually learn to cultivate a relationship with that mystery, and what we bring in is more and more inspiration. And, you know, and material comes with the territory. Now, it's like I said, I was just hired at an enormous salary to write these monthly pieces. And the thing is, I was hired because this person read them because I was doing it for free in my interviews. So, you know, I was doing what I love to do, saying exactly what I wanted to say, and this person says, well, I want to pay you to do that.
Yes. And that's the way it happens. That's my experience. When you in your life has witnessed that, when you say, okay, I'm going to let go of this idea and just know that my needs will be met, and then it just miraculously happens.
Yes, and it also means doing with less if you have to. I mean, when I first started out, I didn't even eat. I mean, but I was willing. I mean, what I valued was the spirit of the journey. And if I had to die figuring it out, I was willing because that's the thing that excited me, the mystery, the magic. And I knew it was there, and how could I be more a part of it? So it means also, okay, well, you're going to have to do with less here. You know, you don't need two SUVs. You don't. You know, so you do with less, and you do with whatever you have to because you're focused on something else, and then the other stuff comes with the territory.
And I don't know about you, but when I'm engaged in art making that's satisfying on a soulful level, I don't think about food and material possessions and any of that, and the time seems to just fly by. Do you have that experience?
Yes, I mean, I think we all have moments of that. Yes, of course.
Now, your present artworks, I saw were have been described, and I think I was described in that way as well, as sarcophagus-like structures or sculptures.
Yeah.
What the images of the work did for me was to remind me again, and we've already spoken about it, of that universal experience of the birth, life, death cycle.
Yes, I mean, it wasn't intentional, believe it or not. When I first started making those because I saw an Egyptian sarcophagus in a book by Carl Jung, mm-hmm. Man and His Symbol. There's this wonderful painted sarcophagus, and I just loved it. So I thought, well, I'll make one. And it all started there, but, you know, in retrospect, I feel, as I said earlier, my life has been so much about, and it's been almost like, you know, the carrot that has led me forward, facing my fears. And what I see in retrospect is that these are very coffin-like, and I'm still making them. And so they're very death-like, and they have beings inside, and they're, you know, but they also, so, you know, to first approach them, one gets the, you know, you might be a little spooked by them. And yet, if you can walk into them, what you find is that they dispense gifts, they do ridiculous things, mechanical things, they make sounds, and there are secret compartments with things in them.
I can't wait to see them in person.
Well, you have
I've only seen images on the internet. You know, they take on a mythic quality, I think, and in that sense, I don't know, just looking at them and examining them as well as I could just from an image, it sort of scratches an itch. I don't know. There's something real about them.
Well, thank you.
Would you say that you create them with a particular intention at this point, or are they pure inspiration?
I don't create them for an intention, but, you know, I could tell you a quick story that kind of illustrates how something might go. We have this great recycle dump on the island here where I live, and I was going to look for something to create with one day when I just felt like doing something, and I found this 4x8 foot slab of cedar. It was this huge slab, about 4 inches thick, 5 inches thick, and carved in one side was animal clinic. It was an old veterinarian sign, but it was huge. And so I brought it home, and I decided to cut 3 figures out. I put the sign face down, and I drew 3 6-foot figures in the most efficient way. And I had cut 2, and I was cutting the third when the phone rang, and it was my first love from high school. You know, it's the story I write about in my book about healing the bloodline. And so, you know, she had found my book, and I hadn't heard from her in 30 years. She found my book and bought the Parabola video, so she knew all about me. And she read the story, Healing the Bloodline, and there was a story about her. And it was like the most painful, you know, event in my life as a young man. Mm. And so we had a great conversation, and it was just wonderful to connect. And when I was done, I went and finished cutting the third figure and flipped it over and situated perfectly the length of the sign was the word anima. You know, if you know what that means, it's the inner feminine of the man that we often project onto our first love and lose ourselves. And so I used that figure, and there's another animus that I created. So I used 2 of those figures, and then there's the union of opposites. So I made a whole piece out of that simple event. But
now
that piece is on
that
our website.
Event. I'm sorry. Right?
I didn't hear you.
Jung would call that a synchronistic event.
Yes.
It's amazing. Now, where are these works? Are they in museums and private collections? Who buys them?
Well, I don't sell them. They're all here.
Okay.
I haven't, you know, over the years, people have asked to buy things, and I actually am having a show now at a art center. But I show them if people, you know, I show them, but I just haven't gone there yet. It's not like I'm against doing that. It's just that I haven't felt the right time for that. You know, it's like, it's just one of those things that I've lived this long following my nose in a sense, and it just hasn't taken me to the place of selling them. And of course, you know, with the attention I've been getting with my book and film, people have been asking, and I've been offered a lot of money, but I just haven't gone there yet.
You talk about wandering as a favorite activity and the importance of choosing time over things. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, it gets back to the unknowing. And in many ways, you know, if we know we're surrounded by the mystery and, you know, we're not out there strategically planning our next dollar or our next advantage, moment of advantage in life, I think we and see life as open possibility. There are things, it's like the story I just told about creating an art piece. There are things that kind of whisper meaningfully in a way. And so I would describe wander as tending that meaning in life, you know. And you do all the things you do. You wash the dishes and you do your laundry and you work in your garden. But at the same time, it's almost like the front for the real activity, which is a kind of watchfulness. You know, you're always watching and looking, and when someone speaks, looking for the deeper meaning behind what they're actually saying. I mean, in many ways, the mystery whispers in everything that we're confronted with in life if we can learn to interpret that language. And to me, that's the place things fall into place and give meaning and give substance to life and to our creation if we're artists.
I read that you awaken at 3 a.m. Is that a place where you find meaning?
Well, it's just what I've always done. I mean, my theory, and I don't know if it's true, my time has always been my own. I've always created a life, as you know from having read some of my story, at great sacrifice. My life has been my own. My time has been my own. And so I think it's just I have found a rhythm that doesn't necessarily fit the rhythm of the world, where most of us have to get up and go to jobs or do things at certain times, so we have to stay. I think for me, I've just found my rhythm, and that is it, just to get up at that time. I think it's interesting. I mean, I read not too long ago that in monasteries and, you know, meditation ashrams and things, that at 3 a.m. is when you're called up to get up to meditate and to pray. So I think there must be something about that time that's kind of holy time, but I find it to be so.
I think I've heard that it's the time when everything is still, even the insects, and things are very, very still at that time, and it's a good time to pray. Do you find that?
I do find that, yes. I think the psychic noise of the world is sort of not in the way as much at that time.
You chose celibacy for many years and said that you were fulfilled by experiencing your inner feminine. Was this a form of deprivation or autoeroticism? I mean, how would you describe that?
Well, I mean, it wasn't something I chose. It was more like I was, again, it's like, why don't I sell art now? It's one of those things that I've trusted life. And you know, it's like you live your life like carrying a canary in a coal mine, and you see where there is life, where there is oxygen, and where there is death. And in many ways, my years of celibacy, you know, and I've certainly had a free life before that, but, you know, after 12 years of celibacy, you know, it was something that my intuition and my knowingness and my clarity brought to the front for me. I mean, it wasn't a choice. It was a part of life that felt like the thing I needed to do. And, you know, and it coming out of that, you know, and ultimately marrying was like terrifying. The moment, you know, because part of me, certainly early on, you know, embraced that possibility, kicking and screaming. And yet I knew the rightness of it and lived. And the moment I said, I can do this, I'm good at this now, is the moment it was like the god says, okay, now go back to the world. And that was sheer terror for me. I mean, because I had so much invested and I felt so clear and you know, about what I could do and what I was doing. And, you know, and I learned a lot about the feminine. I learned a lot how to be with the women without wanting anything and to just be in a very present, different kind of a way than that kind of desirous place. And so there were great gifts that I had to learn, and the moment I learned them, I had to come back to the world, which, you know, which I, again, that became the thing I was afraid of, so that was the thing, that was the place I went. And for many, and for probably 4 years after that, you know, there was a kind of tantric exploration of just exploring sexual energies without being fully engaged sexually. So it was a long process, you know, which ultimately brought me to the place of marriage, and I'm certainly happily married now. But again, it's like letting go. It's like letting go of my art, you know. And, you know, the one thing that hasn't come back in that kind of way is the, you know, selling my art. You know, there are things I just feel like I let them go, and it doesn't matter. And there's ways they just seem to come back. And so that was one of those things.
Would you say that this return to your intimate life with your wife affected or has affected your creativity in any way?
I would say it doesn't matter either way, and that's why I can do it. I mean, that's why I can even do my art, is because it doesn't matter. I think I needed to let go of all that because I was attached to it. You know, I had to be creative without making a thing. I had to, you know, I had to be... I think that was a big part of what I jumped into as well. You know, it's like when I no longer had my work to hide behind as an identity, or in the world setting, who are you and what are you doing? You know, instead of having a thing, or I'm a PhD, or I've got a huge bank account, or I have a pretty car, or I have anything else, it's almost like what you have to be is what the moment calls for. And I think when we can face that kind of nakedness and that kind of vulnerability and just be present with the moment, what comes through is exactly what the moment needs. And often that is the powerful way to connect with the world. And we think, you know, it's something impressive that's going to make a deeper impression on the world. And it does at some shallow level. But what makes the deepest impression is to call up the spirit of the moment and to express it. And that's ultimate creativity.
I think I'd have fun hanging out with you. Just being in the moment. There's a lot of people that do that. I was amazed when I read about and saw the pictures of your wedding gift to Marilyn, a 40-foot meditation tower that you built by hand. Did you find yourself gifted in the process of creating this work of public art?
Yes, it was completely magic. It's also made out of found material, all found things. It's 40 foot. It is a stairway that's made out of 50 old tires filled with dirt, covered with stucco cement. So it's very organic shape. But, you know, it was sheer magic making that tower. I had no idea what I was doing. So I felt, I mean, and it seemed like even when I was about to make some serious mistake, someone would show up at the right time and just say, well, did you think about doing this? And I would have to say no. I mean, it was pure magic. And I don't think I could build another thing like that. And then when it was done, I wanted to have it blessed. Marilyn does Buddhist practice. And so I thought, well, Buddhist. I mean, of course I thought, well, the Dalai Lama would be wonderful, but I knew I wasn't him. But I ended up getting his monks, his personal monks were touring.
To the end of the hour?
His personal monks were touring, and they came, and I asked if they would bless the tower, and they came and did this wonderful 45-minute blessing, which is also in, we have the monks blessing the tower in the parabola video.
That's amazing. Jerry Winstrom, thank you for being with me and our audience tonight. I've so much enjoyed our conversation, and I hope you'll come back.
Well, thank you very much.
If you'd like to learn more about Jerry and Marilyn's life and work, visit their website at www.handsofalchemy.com. Thank you, the listeners, for joining us on Conscious Creating this and every Thursday evening from 6 until 7 Pacific Time. This is your host, Sarah Robinson, wishing you a blissful week of conscious creating.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning into our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.